This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Activist group Lawyers for Human Rights says that there are 15 million undocumented people in South Africa, of which almost 3 million were under the age of 18. This was revealed, of course, during a presentation to the Parliament Portfolio Committee on Health a few months ago. Of course, they're beginning to talk about that. And this number comprises foreign nationals, stateless people, and South African citizens who failed to obtain documentation for various reasons. Lindokuhle Mdabe is my guest tonight, head of the Johannesburg Law Clinic, Lawyers for Human Rights. Lindokuhle, welcome to Power 98.7. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. Lindokuhle, you know, when I look at that figure, and I'm going to just... 15 million undocumented people in South Africa. I think it needs to be broken down, right? Before we overly get, you know, excited and we climb up the wrong tree, it's not 15 million foreigners undocumented in the country. It is to the extent of people who are undocumented being South Africans, being, you know, either stateless and or being foreigners. That's to that's the extent of that number, isn't it?
Yes. It comprises of South Africans and non-South Africans. And that's the real description behind the number here.
Sure. Then a briefing to Parliament and the Portfolio Committee. Why would and to what extent would you begin to brief the parliamentary committee on these kind of findings and these kind of detail, and also the kind of detail I'm going to go into a little bit just now? To what is the achievement, or what do you want to achieve to when you do approach Parliament, when you do approach the Portfolio Committee, and you do begin to talk about undocumented South Africans, particularly also undocumented foreign South Africans in the country, because you then do begin to separate your conversation. Also, you deal with that very specifically and in a very, you know, detailed manner. What is the reasoning behind your briefing to Parliament?
Look, what we do basically is we represent refugees, migrants, and of course, stateless people. What we're trying to do, which is what is part of our theory of change, is that we work with clan communities who could be stateless people, migrant asylum seekers, and other migrants, and we extract their voices and their experiences, and we try to communicate the kind of message that they would want to tell any policy maker or any lawmaker in the country for the purposes of policy or law reform. And so that is the aim behind all of this, is to try and advocate for some sort of policy or law reform. And so we then extract numbers to make a point about that, but also to make a point about the extent of the government's challenges in terms of how it discharges constitutional responsibility to make sure that people have the documents that are necessary for them to live a decent existence. Now, given that we represent stateless people, migrants, asylum seekers, and refugees, we try to quantitatively make a point about the number of people that we represent, but also qualitatively, in the sense that we begin to also tell a story about how they experience the country and whether integration and social cohesion for them within the country is an easy transition or not. And then begin to suggest solutions for government. Yes.
Sure. And I mean, you don't bump into Home Affairs, the department, right, at that particular instance, but are there then recommendations, questions? Are there specific, you know, things that you then ask the committee then to ask of the Department of Home Affairs?
Yes. And because our interfacing with Home Affairs has been something which is good and bad, because most of the time we are misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone knows that the purpose of civil society or any NGO is to make sure that the constitution is implemented and that we review government administrative function and have that have a conversation space where we are able to check the executive and government in terms of how it discharges its constitutional obligation. Now, when we litigate, and when government organs know for a fact that we can litigate, then the relationship between us and them tends to be, I wouldn't say acrimonious, but the interfacing then becomes sour, much more defensive, and so. But it's a useful relationship nonetheless. Now, this is the point I want to make. The point is that despite our hang-ups, we're working with limited information here. And part of how we check government is we also at the same time have to rely on them for information. The Department of Home Affairs do not have basic stats on a group of on specific categories of people that they serve, and they do not provide this information. Now, this number, the 15 million, is a number that is gleaned from the World Bank data set.
Sure. That's where the number of 15 million comes from.
Yes.
Yeah.
I probably won't be able to give you information as to how they came to that figure. But that's the number, and it's been there for quite some time. It dates back 2018, and it's probably more now. We suspect it's more because the claims, especially the refugee claims, the asylum seeker claims, the statelessness cases, the block ID cases, the birth and registration issues, are issues that are piling, and there is a backlog in processing all of those claims. And now COVID then compounded the problem because then the department had to move to an online system. The excuse these days is that they have a hybrid system, which means that they have an online system and then they have a physical system where they allow walk-ins. And of course, our experience is that we're being advised that the walk-in system do not exist. And of course, the only system that now exists, despite the being told that COVID is no longer an issue, it's an online system. And this online system means that
it's fraught with problems in itself.
Yes. So if the people who apply would have to wait without documentation, and people who are new in the country would have to wait without documentation. And then that makes them vulnerable in society because they don't have documentation. They will then have to interface with the police who we are told would ask for bribes in order for people not to be detained, and that becomes like the way in which migrants sort of like experience the country.
Sure. Let me put it to you. Let me put a statement to you, and I'll await your answer to that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to see where this goes. Is it not part of a process though? And maybe, you know, it's come out in your research or your findings and or your experiences, that in ensuring that foreign migrants remain undocumented, and we are talking about these 15 million that are undocumented, and some of those would be foreign right migrants, in ensuring that they are undocumented, it ultimately gives the Department of Home Affairs and works to their objective of facilitating ultimately their removal. So on the one hand, you've got a process that says if we don't give them the kind of documentation that you're talking about, 15 million, it makes it easier for us to actually, you know, remove them by whatever process. And so then you keep a hand or you keep a handle on this problem that you think that you have or foresee. What would you say to a statement of that nature?
Look, let me speak for our community as well as for them. They will probably say, this is not what we aim to achieve. In fact, what we aim to achieve is the best in terms of our constitutional obligation. It's the best in terms of our international law obligation. But their conduct is beginning to suggest that what they're trying to achieve is exactly what you are suggesting in your statement. That we can no longer trust what they say, that we can now begin to judge them by their conduct. And this has been demoralizing for communities, and especially for most of us who are human rights lawyers and activists working in this field. This is demoralizing, and so this is what they've done. So later last year, there was a decision made to say that the ZEP will be cancelled, right?
Which has now been extended.
There's an extension on that. But I don't want to go into why there's an extension, but the ZEP is cancelled. You are told that the situation has improved in Zimbabwe. We know for a fact, and everyone knows, that the situation has not improved in Zimbabwe, right? But the ZEP is cancelled. And there's a backlog project which is processing people who made applications as far back as 2012. That has not been completed. But then there's the online system, which is inefficient, and the numbers are piling, and people are getting arrested. People's banking account are getting cancelled. People are unable to access schools, and people are now paying to give birth at certain hospitals, government hospitals. There are public statements suggesting that we need to withdraw from the conventions that we signed in order to apply international law in the country. There are statements made to suggest that certain countries should pay because we are giving their citizens healthcare services here. And all these statements are made by certain social movements on the ground and political parties, as well as political functionaries, be it the MEC and the minister. Collectively, all of that evidence is beginning to suggest that structurally in South Africa, there's an anti-immigration sentiment, and there is a coordinated attitude, be it conscious or unconscious, to make life difficult for a migrant in this country. And this is what we are told is the real experience of migrants in this country. And the only saving grace, for, be it for us and for communities, is to extract a certain language, whether be it in law and in the constitution, to make a suggestion that all the time that this is a human right friendly country, and that this is a democratic country, and that people who are facing persecution elsewhere can still make this country a place where they can find refuge. This is a place where you are documented, you are able to make a decent living, and be able to participate economically and socially in society. We are constantly trying to make that point against all odds.
So I mean, it's an issue that the South African government really has struggled with since 1994. I'd easily put that out there and say, you know, we before 1994, we were a country where people wanted to leave. After 1994, we were a country that people wanted to come to. Those are the realities. Do you find that, you know, in the difficulty in what you've just been talking to leads also to a difficulty then of establishing how many, for example, foreign nationals would be in the country? How do you determine if you are then in a process of, you know, slack on the documentation aspect, and there are all sorts of lagging across COVID, lagging backlogs, sort of lagging, and all sorts of things? How do you keep a number, or do you, how do you keep pace with who is in the country at whatever point?
You establish in law different permits, you establish in law different documents that you supply to people for different reasons. If one is a migrant, is coming for a visit, they get a visitor's permit.
Yeah.
If one's a spouse, they get
a range of legal documents that give you legal rights.
Yes. The question is does the state have the capacity to provide all those documents, including the documents that they provide to South Africans, the IDs, the passports, as well as the certificate? Well, the answer to that must be yes, because that is in terms of the law. Now, the next question is do they have the capacity? And the answer to that is almost all the time, and a big no.
And if I put political will in there?
For South Africans, one can say there's some political will to make sure that South Africans do have the documents. But when it comes to migrants and people who are stateless or who could be potentially stateless, there isn't any political will to be inclusive, to include the people we call other into an established South African society. And South Africa has always been like that, right? You talk about 1994, but before 1994, the citizenship was only granted to white people, and black people were not citizens of South Africa, but they were citizens of the homelands. So we've always been outside of South African society. And the what has always been intriguing is that those who become part of the South African society then create rules to make it harder for those who they consider other to be part of that society. And that colonial sort of like attitude into inclusion and citizenship and recognition of people and their human dignity and lack thereof because of our colonial legal culture seems to be a continuing thing that we have to grapple with despite the culture of human rights that we already have. And our function these days has now become one where we have to remind the state all the time that they have that citizenship, that permits, that migration is also a human rights issue. Yes.
Sure. Lindo Kuthle, I'm going to bring Sefudi into the conversation. Sefudi, you've been listening very closely.
Yeah, Denzel, you know, sometimes South Africans are being patronized, you know. And what is happening in this country is happening nowhere in this continent. And if I had to choose between being a pariah then and now being like a beehive, I choose to be a pariah because this country patience is overstretched. And you talk of 15 million, and we should separate South Africans that are struggling to get documentation. It may be logistical problem. Can this country, in the economic system that is experiencing at this juncture, be able to afford what is being encouraged? And the ZEP that was done that, it was unprecedented in this continent, and that is not appreciated. South Africans are called people with colonial mentality, and people ought to be disabused of such notions and attitudes, because right now, economically, this country is not even able to fend for its own citizen. Where in this world is it expected to fend for those millions whilst we're struggling with the social system, the health system, housing settlement, and all that? That's not factored. And this, the so-called human rights lawyers, they speak in a vacuum in most cases, Denzel. And it's unfair on us. It's unfair economically. We are depressed. And we are expected to accept, just come, document, without, you know, calculating the consequences of their action. Good evening to you.
Sefudi, thank you so much, Sefudi. I'm going to go back to Lindo Kuthle. Lindo, it's not something you wouldn't have heard before.
Yeah. Yes, there's a long debate around whether which of the human rights are expensive. Is it less expensive to vote? Is it less expensive when compared to the right to provide housing, for instance, or to provide education or health? It seems to me there's always a price to all human rights, right? There is debt, and one has reached a conclusion a long time ago that each human right needs to be budgeted for and it needs to be implemented because they're all the same. There is one layer to that argument. And then another layer is whether South Africa as a polity, as a political economy, is it able to absorb the numbers that it is getting, right? And the argument has always been that South Africa is not an island, and that the South African economy benefits of an unstable African economy. There's so many African companies, DRC, for instance, that are extracting gold at the expense of people in DRC who are now migrants. I'm not saying these companies are responsible for displacement of people in DRC, but most mining companies have, in some way or the other, contributed to displacement of people in the continent. The South African mines benefiting there. The South African companies in Africa, and these companies are citizens of South Africa. They function around the continent. The South African economy benefits from the South African political economy. It is not an island. So there is a connection between Africa and South Africa, and for obvious reasons, whether it be economically, culturally, and socially as well. You just can't separate the two. Now, what is unfortunate is that there is very little political morality in terms of how politics or politicians in South Africa call out human rights violations in other African countries. And then we complain when people are displaced. But there has been very little political speeches from our political heads criticizing what is happening in Tigray, for instance, in Ethiopia. There's very little political messaging criticizing what happened in Zimbabwe. And so we always working in politics with diplomacy at the expense of human rights violation and the displacement of people.
Sure.
Now, these are the results. These are the consequences. You get people migrating into countries where they can make a decent living, where they can start afresh, where they can be safe. The law makes provision for this. The South Africa is part of a number of international conventions which they signed, making commitments to the principle that no one would have to be returned to a country where they would face persecution, and that South Africa will provide some form of refuge and relief for people in such circumstances. Do we then abandon that principle because economically we can't provide for those people? In any event, what is it that we are providing for those people? Because migrants and refugees and asylum seekers and sometimes stateless people in this country would still have to work. They would still have to start up businesses, go to school like everyone else, and out of their own resources make a decent living here. They're not getting handouts like I'm not comparing them to anyone. They're not getting handouts. Period. In this country, they're hard working people, paying tax, working very hard. They just need a place where they could be safe from war and conflict.
Linda Kusle, I have to end it there. It is 1 minute past 11 o'clock. Thank you so much for joining me here. And I'm sure, you know, as this develops, also with Home Affairs being asked to appear before the committee, it would be interesting once they've done that to bring you back and just have a different conversation at that point. Thank you so much.
Yes, we'll wait for that. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. That's Linda Kusle Mdabe, of course, head of the Johannesburg Law Clinic here in Johannesburg.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.